Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly libertarian conversation about the news, conveniently available wherever you find podcasts, including on Spotify. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, Catherine Mangu Ward. Hello, truckers.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Matt. We're going to talk about America's exciting new Supreme Court vacancy here in a moment. But first, imagine, if you will, a podcast with one of the smartest, funniest, libertarianist doctors of literature that has ever tickled your earwaves, going toe-to-toe in lively conversation with politicians, thinkers, and newsmakers of every conceivable hue. Yes, brothers and sisters, theys and thems. I'm talking about our very own Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, the best damn one-on-one game this side of those Magic Bird commercials in the 1980s. Who else but the Fonzie of Freedom do you want interrogating the likes of Garry Kasparov, John McWhorter, Michael Schellenberger, Steven Pinker, Andrew Yang, George Will? You can find the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie everywhere you find podcasts, including on Spotify, and also at the very useful web address of reason.com/podcasts. Lean in. Smell the jacket. Come on, man. Subscribe to the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, moving on.
Thank you, Matt. If I may say, though, I'm flirting with pulling my content from Spotify unless they put more Yoko Ono solo tracks on.
Mm-hmm. Walking on shattered glass or something like that. Thin ice, shattered glass. It's all one big New Republic.
The B-track, Don't Walk Around Here Without Shoes On for a little bit. The B-side to that.
That is some of the best work that John Lennon ever did in those things. Where were we again? Yes. Last week, longtime Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, who appeared in the Declaration of Independence, how independent politics, blah, 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 in 2011, announced his impending retirement at age 83 after nearly three decades on the high court. President Joe Biden, who is the former chairman of the justice-affirming Senate Judiciary Committee, immediately reaffirmed his campaign pledge to pick a black woman for the seat. Breyer's seat, fun fact, used to be known as the Jewish seat back when we did that kind of thing on the high court. Perhaps ironically, I say perhaps because I don't know the definition of the word ironically, the announcement came just days after SCOTUS announced it would be hearing two affirmative action cases that challenged the admission standards at Harvard and the University of North Carolina, which stand accused of discriminating against the category that we call Asians. Catherine, you're a lady. Let's get the argument here started by reading you a quote from another lady, former Congress surfer and presidential candidate Tulsi Gabbard, who today tweeted the following. Biden chose Harris as his VP because of the color of her skin and sex, not qualification. She's been a disaster. Now he promises to choose Supreme Court nominee on the same criteria. Identity politics is destroying our country. What say you, Catherine?
A lot of things are destroying our country. I wouldn't really narrow it down on this fine Monday morning. But so we talked on this podcast when Harris was picked, and I expressed somewhat forcefully the view that I thought the order of operations was wrong there, that to overdetermine a nomination based on race or gender was probably not the way to go. I don't think that because someone was picked having to do with their race and gender, that means they're not qualified. I feel like that should be obvious. And yet, apparently, it's absolutely 1,000 times over not obvious in this discourse. So yeah, I think that this should be an open conversation based on, you know, already quite a small pool of eligible, you know, I suppose anyone can be a Supreme Court justice. So eligibility is not a technical term here, but likely picks. Instead, everyone has chosen to once again lose their mind about race. We like to do that in this country. It is in part because this country has really screwed up on race a lot in the past. So I get that. But as usual, Tulsi Gabbard has a bit of something right in there and has expressed it in a way that I absolutely would never say it, and also gotten her reasoning a little bit ass backward.
Nick, I haven't seen affirmative action this much in the news since the Ward Connerly days back in the in the 90s. Not to be too stonery about this on a Monday morning, but like, isn't there something weird about race? Or at least the way that it's applied to affirmative. No, man. Come on.
I don't.
Come on.
Yeah, Matt.
What
I think
were
that's
you
the
doing?
Californian in you.
Yeah,
talking.
Matt went to California and came back. Whoa, man, isn't there something weird about race?
Did you get one of those medical bandana cards out on the beach?
Yeah.
As I mean, you know, Nick, you've written and observed poignantly through the years, not just about our immigration debates, but also about the ever evolving standard of whiteness. Let alone stuff like Asian or Latino.
I'm also pretty confident that I have a good shot at kicking Italian Americans out of the white category.
I mean, that was
your darndest.
I'm about three really strong podcasts away from that.
Yeah, there's always a pretty tenuous hold. But isn't it, especially considering what we're trying to do, I would imagine, which is help people who are in a disadvantaged situation, yep, is trying to make these weird definitions of race the way to do that rather than saying, hey, look, you're poor. Come on in.
Wow, that's a very different question than what's at stake at the Supreme Court. And to be honest, you know, when it comes to Supreme Court picks, they are always markers for something else. Jack Schaefer, our friend at Politico, the media critic, had a great column about how Supreme Court picks have always been payoffs for partisan service, or almost always for most of the 19th century and a good chunk of the 20th century. So I'm less concerned about any of these kinds of considerations when it comes to the Supreme Court. There is the massive double-barreled affirmative action college admissions case. Cases that are going to be talked about in front of the Supreme Court this term, dealing with Harvard and its treatment of Asian Americans, as well as the University of North Carolina. There, I think there's a more, kind of meaningful debate to have.
Yeah, but that's what I was referring to be clear, is
so,
that aspect.
Yeah, and, one of the things that is paradoxical but makes total sense is that as racial and ethnic identity becomes less strictly determinative of how you proceed in American life, it's going to become more and more, fighting that last mile is going to become more and more bitter. And that seems to be what's at play in political discourse now, especially.
So is it like, sorry to interrupt, but you've made the point or kind of refracted it in the past of like how antitrust battles are usually a sign of like the last gasp of the power of like some,
right,
some like a fading star. So it's a kind of a analogous.
Yeah. I mean, in a way then it's a sign of progress that we're having these battles once again, because ultimately they don't, we can have them now because they're less important than they ever have been. And, that was not true 50 years ago or 60 and 70 years ago. And I think, we are going to have to get to a point in, as a country where we say, okay, we have issues that are related to racial and ethnic identity that are still operative, but we should not be talking about them as if it's 1954 and Brown versus Board of Education, or 1964 and 65, where we're talking about civil rights acts and voting rights acts, where people were clearly disenfranchised from participating fully in American society because mostly of racial identity. When it comes to college admissions, what is really powerful about the cases that are going in front of the Supreme Court, one is at a public university, one is at a private university, but ultimately it's going to come down to the treatment of Asian Americans who, by virtually every account, are doing extremely well at working the meritocratic qualifications that were, everybody was told this is what you need to do in order to get into Harvard, in order to get into a good public university, in order to succeed in America. You have to study hard, don't drink, don't, be an asshole, and really hit your marks and become a full, kind of fleshed out person who has other, who gives volunteer time, who has a bunch of extracurriculars. And what is interesting to me is that Asian Americans now are, they've mastered a vision of meritocracy And now they're being told, you know what, that's not actually what we want. What we want are people who overcome more difficulties than you seem to have. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. What it means to get into college or to be a good college student changes all the time too. But it's, you know, we're having fundamentally false conversations about these things all of the time.
Peter, to build on the Gillespie-Jack Schaefer point for a second, I've seen a fair amount of commentary from the likes of Coleman Hughes or Eugene Volokh over the Volokh conspiracy, basically saying that, hey, look, the Supreme Court has always been a political pick with sometimes, you know, crass political box checking considerations done kind of on the quiet. Maybe it's okay to do it out loud.
Well, I certainly think that it has often been done quietly, and to state it is in some ways adding transparency to a process that was opaque beforehand. And so you could make an argument that the fact that Biden is saying this and just making it the text rather than the subtext is an improvement. Does that make it better or worse? I don't know. I mean, I guess I sort of think that when you're selecting at the level of Supreme Court justices, everyone who could possibly get that job is qualified for the job. And so part of what you are doing is selecting for composition. And since you brought up the affirmative action in colleges, that's true, too. And to me, that seems like the best argument for the kind of selection that goes on in college campuses and at the Supreme Court. And this is not necessarily, to be clear, one that I think is good enough that it should win the day. But at the same time, you're not just selecting each student individually out of context of the rest of the student body. At the same time, you are not just selecting each justice out of context of the rest of the justices, right? You're selecting them in the context of who else is sitting on the court, or who else is in the student body for that year. And so there is a sort of an overall compositional argument that you can make for elite institutions that I think at least has to be weighed here in this argument.
Catherine, we're about ready to go through, I think, our fourth seat-filling exercise in 6 years, which is one of the bigger changing of the guards at the Supreme Court in a generation or so. The last ones haven't gone so great in terms of national comity.
You noticed that too.
Do you have any?
Maybe it's because there's too many Catholics involved.
Too many Catholics. Way too much Harvard and Yale. So will you, Catherine, commit to no more Yale justices on the Supreme Court? Just as an opening salvo. But no, what are some of your non-Democrat, non-Republican, non-voter pleas, P-L-E-A-S, that you would like to give to people as we embark upon yet another Supreme Court nominating fight?
Yeah, first of all, I am strongly pro a 100% Yale Supreme Court, and I will not be intimidated by you just because you couldn't manage to finish college or whatever is your problem.
It's not a good yachtsman.
So, you know, I think actually the fact that we're talking about four appointments as a large number of appointments suggests, you know, I won't say like, I think Peter's broad point was correct about the fact that you are sometimes balancing a body, or you're kind of looking at the complement that you're creating. But an attempt to right the wrongs of various racial injustices, or to bring balance to the court when we are still talking about such a small number of appointments, is necessarily going to just make winners and losers, right? Like, it's there's no way to satisfy everyone. It simply won't happen. Honestly, my plea for like how to get to national comedy in the face of this appointment fight is, could the vetters just do a really good job? Like, I don't want to see a nominee that
like
has
Eddie Vedder.
Yes, I'm sure he would do a great job.
Is he still on Spotify? Do we know
of selecting a Supreme Court justice? But
a big Neil Young fan.
No, I just don't want to have somebody dragged up in front of me because somebody didn't find a skeleton in their closet. Like, find the skeletons and just keep those people out of the process. I mean,
Do you think that Brett Kavanaugh should have been bounced then?
So I'm being grumpy about this, but I actually do think the Kavanaugh fight was so poisonous. I think he's actually a fine Supreme Court justice as far as these things go. I don't think in the end that his alleged misconduct was disqualifying, but it wrecked our shit. Like, that conversation did horrible, horrible things to this country, including turning basically every middle-aged white woman into someone who thinks that the Supreme Court is not legitimate anymore. Like, that was a very, very high-cost nomination. And in the spirit of, there are actually a bunch of people out there who could do this job well, even though, you know, in this case, many of them won't be considered because Biden has narrowed the, he has narrowed the criteria by race and sex. I just, out of that pool, could we just find someone who's pretty not problematic? And I know that's a big ask, and I know that we probably won't get there, but I, you know, first and foremost, I would like to have someone who totally shares my principles on the court, and that's not going to happen. So then second, I would like to have an appointment process that does not tear the already tissue paper thin fabric of our democracy asunder. I know that there are people who don't want to hear that. I know that some listeners to this podcast will be like, what's wrong with you? Why do you want comedy? We should have victory for libertarian principles on the court. But a totally libertarian court with no legitimacy does not do the cause of freedom any good. And I think it's legitimate to try and balance those considerations.
So you just want to defer to experts. I get it, Catherine. That's pretty normal.
I love experts, Matt.
The role of experts.
Speaking of...
Why don't we have Anthony Fauci pick the next Supreme Court?
Hell, hey, let's just put him on the court.
You know,
let's just get it done.
People are saying that Biden, you know, the smart move for Biden is to put Kamala on the Supreme Court, freeing up the VP slot. I think an even better move would be as if Biden nominated himself. He doesn't want to
be freeing up the presidential slot.
He doesn't want to be president, right? You know, come on.
This is a
it's no fun.
This is a borderline non sequitur, but since someone invoked the name of Fauci, I just have to share this quote from him from this morning, apparently. He was on the New York Times podcast. He says, "The cautious are being cautious a lot because the uncautious are not being cautious, and the uncautious resent the caution of the cautious."
Oh, my God. That's so Donald Rumsfeld. Most Rumsfeldian thing I have ever heard post-Rumsfeld. That's gorgeous. That is known unknowns.
He's got to be signaling to some kind of master, the paymaster, to get me the hell out of here.
That was the signal.
I mean, to be clear, what I would actually like to do is just clone Gorsuch. Like, that's what I would genuinely like to do. Like, just another Gorsuch. That would be... Excellente.
But, Clone Gorsuch is one of my favorite German industrial bands, by the way. Very very good stuff. Speaking of industrial bands, we are well into the second week of one of the dumbest controversies I can remember, but although maybe that's just because I'm getting so old that I forget last week, as a matter of course. This began in earnest when the Ernest and geriatric and frequently insane Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Neil Young through the ultimate OK Boomer hissy fit, and I'm borrowing from Nick Gillespie's language on that, in giving the streaming service Spotify an ultimatum. It's either Neil Young or the guy you just spent $100 million acquiring, Joe Rogan, because of his alleged COVID podcasty misinformation. It took Spotify at least a couple hours to say, gosh, Neil, hope to see you again soon. After that, a bunch of Twitter activists, including a non-insubstantial number of journalists, at least judging by my terrible Twitter feed, that it's my fault, I guess, had just started egging on every Depends-wearing rocker out there to try...
Which is to say all of them.
All of them at this point, to also get on with a lot of, like, total misinformation, actually. Like, oh, Dave Grohl's off of it now, and Paul McCartney, none of which is true. I think they got Joni Mitchell...
And Nils Lofgren.
Nils Lofgren. I don't know how Spotify is going to. But I should point out that as of this morning, both Nils and Joni are still on the service. Spotify released a big statement over the weekend. Joe Rogan filmed a video clip that I encourage people to look at on his Instagram. Nick, I know that you are a fan of Neil Young as a performance artist. particularly trans and whatever the hell that Devo thing was that he did in 82, which is absolutely
from Human Highway. It's fantastic.
Absolutely wonderful. Everyone should check it out. But I found this whole thing discombobulating and disconcerting. Maybe start with.
And you have to understand, dear listeners, Matt Welch, as he's saying that, was flapping his hands.
Yeah, flapping. Just like a pigeon trapped.
Aspergery bird trapped. Jonathan Livingston Seagull brought down to earth.
Thank you. Good Neil Diamond soundtrack on that one, speaking of which.
Yeah. Speaking of good Neil.
Maybe start with, what is it that this episode shows about what mainstream journalists don't understand about Joe Rogan? Or at least if you feel qualified to comment on that.
Yeah, no, one of the most amazing things is, and I just saw a tweet from somebody at the New York Times shortly before this podcast, which was asking the right question, or which said, you know, maybe more of us in the mainstream, you know, lamestream media should be asking ourselves, why is Joe Rogan so popular, rather than attacking people who listen to him.
And I think, let me follow up quickly, because that's Matt Rosenberg, who's a good reporter over there. He was immediately challenged on Twitter by Nicole Hannah-Jones, saying basically, like, we know why he's popular. It's because of racism. So maybe that's the next
That really
question.
Does get at the appeal of Joe Rogan, and especially to have a couple of COVID, either denialists or moderationists on. I think one of the things that comes out of this is that, you know, it would make sense for people in older media forms to understand what Spotify is. The number of people I saw on Facebook and elsewhere who were like, you know, I'd never heard of Joe Rogan before, and I don't really understand Spotify, et cetera, but now I'm going to pronounce on things. Rogan has become a phenomenon. I mean, where he is probably the most popular media personality on the planet. His podcast episodes supposedly get around 10 million downloads per show. He's a force of nature on all of this. And I think one of the main reasons he's popular is because he knows he doesn't know that much. He kind of plays a meathead who will talk to anyone and talk to them at length and have conversations with them. He's an autodidact, and I think people find it interesting to kind of learn along with him. That also means he's typically a captive of the last expert or person that he talked to. Which is, you know, not a good thing. But Rogan would be the first person to tell you that, like, you shouldn't be taking medical advice from him, probably not even workout advice. But I think what one of the things that Rogan represents, and in different ways, Howard Stern used to represent this, and Glenn Beck used to represent this, where they are curious, smart people who ask questions about power and talk to a lot of different people and kind of have fun with it and are remaking themselves, as they are talking. And Rogan adds to that an element of, you know, he's remaking himself physically. He's a mixed martial arts commentator, a UFC commentator. And he's both a workaholic, a family man, an entrepreneur, and he's trying to learn more about the world. That's exciting to watch. He also does drugs unapologetically and in a way to both have fun, but also to expand his consciousness. He's big on psychedelics and things like that. He's an interesting phenomenon. And at this point, he's a more interesting phenomenon than Neil Young is, who in the day was also really kind of fascinating and challenged, you know, perceptions of what rock music could do, what singer-songwriters could do, and even what activists could do. Young has his own long history of misinformation, including a whole album dedicated to attacking Monsanto and genetically modified organisms. You know, and again, for me, the two big takeaways from it all are that we live in a fantastic fucking world of media production and consumption, and we can all do, you know, get more and more of what we want on the terms that we want. And then something that my mother, who was not educated, but had some, Italian immigrant wisdom in her, who said, never take advice from celebrities. It's like, you can learn from them, both negatively and positively, and sometimes they're right about stuff, but you're an idiot if you are looking to a podcast host or a rock star.
You were right the first time, Nick. Yeah. Podcast hope.
Hope. Or a rock star for guidance on the finer points of living.
Speaking of taking advice from celebrities and podcasters, Reason contributor on occasion and very good writer, Kat Rosenfield, had, I think over the weekend or in recent times, a Twitter poll. She's like, okay, you who are on Twitter, who is a Rogan listener, have you gotten vaccinated or not? Which is a pretty interesting exercise. Obviously, it's not science, but and like the, you know, vast majority had gotten vaccinated. It's kind of clear from that snapshot that it's not like like people change their behavior in this way because of Rogan. I think it misunderstands his appeal. Catherine, you were telling me this morning that Rosenfield also got into trouble over the weekend somehow because people are stupid.
Yeah. So she went on Reliable Sources and she was trying to describe, she was basically defending Rogan, and she was trying to describe the phenomenon whereby elite gatekeepers think they know better, and in trying to gatekeep out what they perceive to be bad information, they end up further radicalizing and polarizing people who were fans of those supposed purveyors of bad information. And in so doing, she did a thing. And I actually think this is a slightly gendered thing. I've noticed this because I edit a lot of interviews, right? Like one thing we do is like Nick conducts a lot of interviews and sometimes we use them in the print magazine. And when you translate from verbal to written, you see these quirks. And I think women are more likely to do this, which is she spoke in someone else's voice to make a point. So she said something like, "We think we know better." And by we, she did not mean herself. She meant the elites. She meant the media elites. She meant the group of people who are trying to gatekeep out Rogan. And many people misunderstood the rhetorical device that she was using and decided that she was an enemy of the Rogan Nation or whatever Rogan fans are called. I'm not particularly a big Rogan listener. He doesn't really scratch my itch, but I believe his own account of himself, which he put actually quite nicely in the Instagram post that Matt referenced that he did a bit earlier. He basically just said, listen, this podcast started off as just fucking around with my friends and talking. And it is now, to quote him, an out of control juggernaut that I barely have control over. And then he said, I do all my own booking and sometimes I don't prepare a lot. And I'm just interested to talk to people that have interesting things to say. And that's true. That's true. Like other people have agendas. I have an agenda. Joe Rogan is much more of like an open-ended seeker bro. And I think there are a lot of open-ended seeker bros out there who appreciate that energy and want to get in on that. And he said in this message, like, maybe I could prepare a little more for interviews. Or maybe I could like book someone on one side of a controversy and then book someone on the other side, like the next episode, just to kind of like balance it out. And it was like, yeah, those are good notes for improvement that you just gave yourself. Like, you're not wrong. And he concluded by saying it's good to have some haters. And that, I think, is the thing that everyone is missing. Like, it is good to have some haters. It is good to have people that disagree with you who have loud voices and platforms. And Joe Rogan is sometimes somebody else's hater. He is providing that service as well as being on the receiving end of that service. And he's very clear about the mode he's operating in. That mode appeals to a lot of people. They don't like the like ghost of Walter Cronkite, voice of God nonsense that they are getting from an awful lot of other sources. They don't want to be told the one truth, especially when people keep getting that wrong. And Rogan pointed that out. He was like, listen, there's a whole bunch of stuff about COVID that the mainstream now accepts as true, that people were getting blocked and banned and just generally socially sanctioned for saying some years ago. And those are all good points. And if your framework is, hey, I just want to talk about stuff, that's a legitimate framework. Not everything is a platforming decision. Not everything is an endorsement. Not everything is like a conclusion. Sometimes it's cool to just talk about stuff and it's good to have some haters.
I think
in conclusion.
Yeah.
I think that there's a couple of points that you and Nick raised that kind of get to the heart of a thing, which is one, the open-ended seeker bro ethic, and two, just sort of a sense of fun. Like, actually having fun here. It's striking how those things are not enshrined values in what passes for elite journalism nowadays. Like,
well, it's also it's important to understand too. Part of the backdrop of all of this is places like CNN and the New York Times, and the New York Times is flourishing in a way, but it is no longer the hegemonic force that it was 20 years ago. The people who work there are well paid and they're treated with respect. But, it, you know, the New York Times hasn't been able to open or close a Broadway play or, you know, kill a movie or a book with a bad review in decades. And that's not coming back. And somebody like Joe Rogan is, you know, is ascendant. There's a new media forms that are ascendant. And I think that's part of it. When you, what, you know, I mean, I think
his
all
cultural
of us,
power is probably most equivalent to Oprah with maybe a little bit of Larry King thrown in.
Yeah. And it's a different type of power, right? It's not, you know, like we're going to shut something down or open something up, but it's growing and it's big. And when you, you know, I've spent a lot of time over the years at a place like CNN, which is declining. MSNBC is declining. Fox News is actually declining overall. You know, and they get kind of pissy when they start to see this type of thing rising. And that, you know, to bring it back to Neil Young, one of the things that it's always kind of disappointing is, you know, he was part of a generation of rock stars who, like, you know, broke new ground and kind of changed the way things were done. But he's not comfortable with change that doesn't benefit him. Or it doesn't respect him, you know, in the way that he didn't necessarily. And, you know, the people at Atlantic Records in Buffalo Springfield and at Reprise, where he did most of his best solo work, you know, he's not an agent of change. He was an agent. He liked change that benefited him and his generation and things like that. And, you know, creative destruction, you know, levels all of us over time, you know. So I think that's a really important factor that is going on in this. Rogan is 54. You know, he's practically a boomer himself, but he represents a vast change that is ascendant in the way people want to produce and consume content. And that bothers people who are benefiting from an older model that's waning.
He also told on his Instagram post, he told this like genuinely dumb rambling story about
Neil
being
Young.
A bouncer at a Neil Young concert, which is exactly what you guys are getting. Like that story, like nobody with a single like editor or gatekeeper or like any infrastructure around their creative production, like he would have recorded that thing and then they would have cut out the weird dumb anecdote about Neil Young.
And here are talking about it. It's
that
great.
Would have been the wrong decision. Like that would have been how it was supposed to be done. And he does not exactly do things how they are supposed to be done. And people really dig that. And I think, you know, at least in one corner of the internet that I'm on, saying that you listen to Joe Rogan on like a like on Twitter or like in a dating profile or whatever, in some ways has become like the new I love Ayn Rand. Like there's a certain type of woman, especially, who is just like, that's the reddest flag, like peace out. No, thank you. And like, you know, he accepts that role. I think he's just like, yeah, I'm the guy who talks to those guys. And if you don't like those guys, fine. Like, don't do business with them. Don't do business with them on your dating profile. But like, it's
although
that's
we support
what we're calling
sex
it now.
Work, right?
It's work.
It's a media brand that's also an identity, and you know, that's a phenomenon that's ascendant, and it's. You know, it has to have these weird rough edges. It has to have this kind of, God forgive me, authenticity, because a lot of the stuff that we're told we're supposed to like doesn't have that, and people want it.
I think an underrated aspect of Neil Young's decision to pull his music here is that it is mostly about bit rates for streaming music. And literally, it's just about Neil Young hating Spotify's music quality. He has long hated low-res music streams. Like, this has been a big bugaboo for Neil Young. Back in the iPod days, before people carried, your iPod was also a phone, he backed a dedicated high-resolution audio player, the Pono. He's an audiophile, which means he is kind of a crank in the sense that all audiophiles are sort of cranks who believe crazy shit about spending $10,000 on like a tube for your $100,000 monoblock amp, right? That like is going to power one of your speakers, just one, right? And you and like you have tape all over your living room because you've marked off the exact spots that everything has to be and the angles that it all has to be towed in at, right? Like he has opinions on all of those things. And I kind of relate. Like I have opinions on a lot of that stuff too. I've tried to keep the tape out of my living room. You know, but like I spent this weekend looking at network streamers and higher quality DACs. And so I kind of get it. But like that, so much of this is Neil Young just having always harbored a grudge against Spotify for its relatively lower quality music streams. And he actually released a statement, I believe on his website, saying that he felt better after pulling his music because now he could rest, like be peaceful about the fact that no one was listening to his music the wrong way. And actually, though, there was like a good little bit in the in his statement that said, you know, private companies have the right to choose what they profit from, just as I can choose not to have my music support a platform that disseminates harmful information. And I think also, you know, implicit in this was that he felt like the platform was distributing subpar versions of his art. And that is like, I'm joking a little bit, but I also genuinely think that Neil Young is so obsessive about streaming quality and about bit rates that this is actually a big part of why he has pulled his music, is because he always hated Spotify and he was always frustrated with the fact that Spotify has not rolled out the hi-fi, high-res service that they have been promising for a year or so.
And he was always frustrated that he wasn't getting enough money from Spotify when he wasn't on it, and so joined it because Spotify was the everything store. Go on, Nick.
He also just inked a deal or announced a deal with XM Sirius to do a limited engagement about his new album, Barn, where he's going to release that there and talk about it and curate a list with people like Crosby, Stills, Nash, as well as Joni Mitchell and a bunch of other people that he likes. So, you know, again, part of the
story. He wants to live. He wants to give.
This, yeah.
He's been a miner, you know, for a heart of gold.
He's looking for a heart of gold. He's saddling up the Palomino and driving back to his hometown.
I hate you.
We could do this all day and all night, although that's a Kinks song. Again, the thing that's good is that, you know, I think his gesture of saying it's either me or him is a real Karen move, and is disturbing from a hippie who benefited from a loosening of the ability to kind of distribute speech that might have been shut down, you know, in the 50s, et cetera. But the upshot of all of this is like Neil Young fans can still find his stuff for free on YouTube. They can go to XM Sirius. He has a website that actually has high res video as well as audio for $20 a year. You can listen to everything Neil Young has ever put out, plus things that he's never officially released. And you can listen to Joe Rogan for free on ad supported Spotify, or you can pay, you know, like everybody wins as long as we keep the notion at bay that like some things should be just kicked off the internet altogether.
But this is the other thing though that we should talk about here, is that what people are asking is actually kind of weird, because if Spotify kicked Joe Rogan off of Spotify, then Joe Rogan would either go to another platform that paid him a lot of money or would just go back to the open web and would arguably be available to an even larger group of people. And so there is no world in which Spotify can make a decision that results in Joe Rogan not being available to exactly the same number of people that he is available to now, if not more people, right? And so I guess I don't even understand what people want from Spotify here, except to sort of lay down a marker that Joe Rogan is bad or something.
People at Spotify were saying that when Joe Rogan signed with them, there was a revolt of mid-level douchebags at Spotify who were like, I don't want to be part of this.
There was already there was already a crack that this wedge went into, right? And there's been a bunch of back and forth. I'm sure you've seen it about, you know, oh, this particular episode has disappeared, or did it really disappear, or is it a glitch, or is it censorship? There's already been a kind of sub rosa back and forth about this, and it's just percolated up now. But I agree, like, there is this interesting thing where the architecture of podcasting matters here, right? Like, the fact that you can distribute a podcast, you know, the fact that we say on this podcast, get us wherever you get your podcast, because there are so many ways to get your podcasts. And I don't think it's a coincidence that in this space, people are less afraid to say what they want to say. They are less afraid of this type of cancellation than on other more monopolistic platforms. I think that it's really worth being vigilant about regulations that will lock in platform monopolies for the sake of limiting misinformation, right? That's what this is supposed to be about. In the end, it's supposed to be like somehow Joe Rogan is a vector for misinformation and we want to limit it. But nobody can do that with podcasting because it's really very hard to stop someone from podcasting. This is why every single person
in Catherine, the... you may occasionally have wanted to stop some of the people on this podcast.
All of you
from
individually.
Podcasting,
but also every single person
and
I know.
Found yourself stymied.
Every single person I know has a podcast. Like I really can't be clear. Like, any person that I interact with in an even moderately sustained way in this world at this point has a podcast or had a podcast or sort of has a podcast that they haven't updated in a long time. And that's good. Those podcasts are mostly bad. No offense. But
watch
like,
it's
good that that is how this form functions. And that is different from TV, where there are government gatekeepers. It is different from cable, where there are semi-regulated, quasi-governmental gatekeepers. It is different from radio, where there are government gatekeepers. And like, I just think that's important to keep in mind, that this is a form that really makes censorship especially hard, and that's a great thing about it.
I would finish this segment by just pointing out that there was a post-initial hissy fit clarification from the Young camp saying, no, we're not trying to kick Joe Rogan off Spotify. Like, no, dude, you gotta, if you with either him or me, that's what you're doing. Like, own it. And then the same thing happened with other kerfuffles that we don't have time to get into. But there, you know, when you're asking someone to not work at a place because, or not be broadcast by a place because you don't like what they say and think that they're a bad person, that's what you're doing. Own your censoriousness, you lily-livered, old, liver-spotted weirdos. All right. Reminder to email your questions to the roundtable, which we're going to read one of here in a second, to a roundtable@reason.com. I'm going to do this without a but first, although I was really thinking about like hyping up Suderman's cocktail newsletter for that, just to make Catherine mad. Preferably when you send this.
It's a good newsletter, folks.
Okay, it happened. We did it anyways. But please, when you email your questions as necessary, and I think we all realize it's necessary more often than not, send a pronunciation guide of your name, unless you like the creativity. This one, for example, comes from Anders, which is pronounced like Ponders without the P. Thank you, Anders. He writes, hi, round table. I'm a pretty radical libertarian. Living in New York, D.C., California is my personal nightmare. Why do you guys live there? Are there important journalisming reasons? How do you feel about the idea of voting with your feet? Extra bonus points if Suderman can answer without using the phrase cocktail bar. Of course, you know that's not possible. Catherine, why do you live where you've always lived?
Because I've always lived here, at least in part. I truly am a Beltway baby, and I love it. This is my home. So first of all, don't be a hater. This is my home. I actually have early childhood memories of visiting my great aunt Pat in Akron, Ohio, and her talking about those people in Washington. And it, like, literally being a little kid and being like, you mean like my family? Like, what are we?
Little,
what do
little
you
Catherine
mean,
with
great
a,
aunt?
Little Catherine with the pigtails?
Great aunt Pat?
The pigtails and the
I
big
did have pigtails.
Brezhnev glasses?
Rocked the pigtails, huge glasses, bangs, aggressive bangs at that time. So I think, you know, even then I'm sensitive to this, like, idea that, you know, there's somehow, like, the Washington, the cesspit. Not wrong, but we're just so much more also. We are a cesspit and a lovely city and place to raise children and live your life. you know, I think there are different subtypes of libertarians. And believe you me, one of my favorite hobbies is building taxonomies of types of libertarians. I'm not alone in that. Other libertarians, one type of libertarians is the type that likes to build taxonomies of types of libertarians. But I love and respect the I would never live in DC, I would never live in a city type. I'm just not that type. The type of authoritarianism that chafes with me, the emotional resonance of libertarianism for me, is not the kind that presses in on you in a city. It's the kind that presses in on future generations with regulations and very large budgets. And it's the kind that presses in on communities that are heavily policed. But that isn't my experience of living in a city. And also, we have good cocktail bars here.
Well done. Peter, you live there by choice. You grafted your life there. You like bought a dog or something. Why do you live there?
Two. I mean, I came from Florida, so maybe that's just the reason is anywhere is better than Florida. No, I mean, there are professional reasons. I write about politics and policy, and I work for a DC-based magazine, right?
And Los Angeles, technically.
Yeah,
we have
people living in the desert.
This is true. But it's just much easier to do this job, I find, being part of the kind of Washington community where you can go and talk to people and you're sort of circulating in a world full of other people who do the same thing that you do and have some of the same professional interests. But the other thing, you know, whether it's DC or New York, you know, it would be hard for me to not live in a city because I like being able to walk everywhere I need to go. I like being on busy streets with tall buildings and stuff to do and just having a lot of people around and having sidewalks and not, I grew up in the suburbs. I grew up in a place where to go pretty much anywhere, you had to get into an automobile and drive there. And I don't like driving very much. And I really like walking. And so I like living in a city where the furthest I ever have to go from my house on a regular basis is about 2.5 miles. And that's, you know, a 45-minute walk. And that just, it makes my life really enjoyable to be able to walk basically everywhere I need to go and to have people around and to have stuff around, whether it's cocktail bars or whether it's movie theaters. I mean, I have five interesting movie theaters within walking distance from my house. It's just a huge difference from where I grew up, where, you know, often I had to drive 45 minutes or an hour to get to go see a movie. And that's not true here. And so there's just sort of cultural opportunity that is available in a place like Washington, D.C., even Washington, D.C., and even more so someplace like New York City that isn't available in less dense areas.
Nick, what's your excuse?
You know, first off, I've lived in suburbs, I've lived in small towns, I've lived in dying cities and vibrant cities. I've lived in a prison. I've lived in the premier prison town in America. So I've been a lot of places. Huntsville, Texas, you know, death penalty capital of the planet. You know, 80 miles north of Houston with a gigantic statue of Sam Houston dressed as a gentleman farmer. He lived out his post-political days there. And when the statue went up, it's the largest statue in America of a historic figure. I don't know, it's like 80, 100, 120 feet, and they had to sand down the crotch after they put it up because they thought it was too provocative right there on the interstate. So I've lived places. I like New York.
I'm
right
absolutely
now.
Googling right now just to be clear to see the crotch for myself.
Yeah. You know, I'm at a stage in my life where my kids are grown and out of the house, and I can go back to the place where I was born. When I was living in Huntsville, I kind of came up with the concept of, you know, we talk a lot about the cost of living, but there's also, you know, a question about the demand for living. And there was not a lot of demand for living in Huntsville, Texas. It didn't have a lot of amenities that appealed to me. And New York does. And, you know, it's costs and benefits. And the things that I like, according to the subjective theory of value, there's a lot of them here in New York right now for me. And I'm willing to pay those costs. I realized when I lived in Huntsville and to a certain degree, Oxford, Ohio, which is a college town about 35 miles outside of Cincinnati, which is a mediocre city at best. Like I'm willing to pay a premium to be around the kinds of stuff I like, a lot of which Catherine and Peter kind of talked about. plus, you know, it's people, it's things and stuff like that. And I think it's worth thinking about, you know, places to live offer different kinds of bargains to people. And some of it is relatively low regulation and low taxes, but generally that comes with fewer things to do, you know, and it goes the other way as well. And I'm happy to make those trade-offs right now. And you can go screw if you don't respect other people's values.
I don't think
Ponders was talking that way, but it's, you know, a lot of people do, you know, when they say, how could you live in New York? Ted Cruz, you know, denouncing New York values and all of that kind of stuff. Like, fuck Ted Cruz.
I will say that the last 2 years or so have made me question my commitment to city living as much as I really have. I mean, I really consider myself somebody who just wouldn't want at this point in my life to live, you know, in a place where I would have to drive basically everywhere. The city has become a different place in the last 2 years, and in some ways one that appeals to me a lot less, in part because there is less cultural opportunity because there are fewer things that are happening.
I if I wasn't a 53-year-old in a family of four, and with all kinds of you know, local roots, now after 10 years of living in Brooklyn, I'd probably move to Miami. I think Florida's great.
I don't know why you live in Brooklyn, but Brooklyn, that's crazy.
Brooklyn is wonderful. No, I mean, I moved here for television opportunity, which doesn't exist for the most part anymore, and to also because we wanted to send our kids to a good public school. One of those things isn't really happening anymore. Yeah, that's a lull.
We really got turned around on that.
And also, we wanted to live in a vibrant commercial place that doesn't ban, you know, billboard advertisements and like color on buildings. The way that DC kind of like the drabness was pounding on my Southern California raised brain. So all those things, great. And there's much to like about here. And part of my response to COVID, the deep, dark well of spring of 2020 is I kind of wanted to be here for when it snaps back, because that was such an awful dehumanizing experience, and at a time when there was sort of a rising anti-cosmopolitanism in our politics, I kind of wanted, like, hey, screw it, I'm staying. Now I'm staying for good, kind of thing. I don't know if I feel that as strongly now. It just would be kind of a hassle to pick up and move with an entire family, and it's sort of a brain project that would be large. But I'm very conscious right now of the gap in vitality. Perceived vitality in my own brain, maybe, between the old blue states that are now unaccountably or accountably losing population. California is the one that just blows my mind, having been from there, and places like Florida and Texas that are just gaining people and are kind of young, and people kind of don't give a French. You know, maybe getting a little bit of wanderlust. So I understand the question. But also, you know, we work in media. Media lives in New York, Washington, and LA. It does make sense for us to be near where those conversations are taking place and trying to insert ourselves in them, in part so that we can represent the views of people who would never come within 3,000 miles of a city like New York. Okay, let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural arena. Peter, why don't you lead us off?
I saw the band Cursive, an old post-punk band from Omaha, Nebraska, one of the early bands on the Saddle Creek label, which also gave us Bright Eyes, the sort of Connor Obersty folk emo project that persists to this day. I've been listening to Cursive for so long. Their 2000 album Domestica, which is a sort of a post-punk concept album about a bad breakup, is one of my favorite albums of all time. I have listened to it thousands of times. Easily. Sometimes I recall I had to drive between Kentucky and Florida, which is like a 10 to 12 hour drive. I did this, 40 times or something from like 1999 to 2003 or so, when I was sort of alternating between Kentucky and Florida. And there would be times when I would just listen to Domestika on repeat because you had to like change CDs and stuff. And so it was easier to just let it play the whole time. And so it is one of my favorite albums of all time. I'm a big fan of their later work as well. And yet I had never managed to see Cursive play live. And so it was just great to see them play a set made up of mostly older songs for a fairly small crowd. This was at the Black Cat, an old rock club in Washington, D.C., Washington, D.C. on 14th Street. And it seats, I don't know, fits 600-700 people in its current form. And there were maybe 125 people tops there. It was a small enough crowd that the band actually remarked on it. They were like, man, we play the Black Cat all the time. And I mean, not recently, but like all the time. And this is the smallest crowd we've had in like 15 years here. And they talked about how it was like, hey, are you guys sure you're being responsible being here? Are you sure? Cause you know what? They were so happy to be playing music in front of people. And that was part of what was like joyful about it was they were just like, you know what? It's been 2 years and we think you should be able to do stuff that you enjoy and that is fun now. And they were right. And it was just great. And it was great to see them play with such energy and exuberance and to be vibing off of even this very small Tuesday night, mid pandemic crowd. And to go back to the question, you know, that our listener sent in, I was able to walk to this place. It was in 20 minutes from my house. And so I walked there and walked back. And that's not something you can do in a lot of places in the United States.
Nick, what have you been consuming?
I watched the Netflix documentary, The Alpinist, like Alpine, about the mountain climber and rock climber Marc-André Leclerc, a Canadian-born, rock climber. If you were into free solo or into thin air or into the wild, excuse me. Another book about an intrepid young autistic boy who finds adventure and much more in the great outdoors. I highly recommend The Alpinist. I say this as somebody who is extremely familiar with documentary filmmaking. It's an incredibly manipulative movie in all the best ways that the best documentaries are. And it raises a series of questions for me about narratives that we tell about young idealistic athletes. I actually don't want to talk too much about it because it would be giving away too much. But for me, I walked out of it thinking about, foolhardy narratives that we tell culturally about young, smart, single-minded men. Very good movie, The Alpinist.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I checked out Brian Kaplan's brand new book, which came out, I guess, last week or maybe 2 weeks ago, Labor Econ versus the World, Essays on the World's Greatest Market. If you are a Brian Kaplan fan, as I am, perhaps you enjoyed his graphic novel about open borders. Perhaps you enjoyed The Myth of the Rational Voter. Perhaps you enjoyed The Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids. Perhaps you enjoyed The Case Against Education. This book is not like those books. It's still good. It's still Brian Kaplan-y, but it's basically a collection of his posts at EconLog. So it's short. It's bloggy. I think it is, my guess is that it is intended to capture people who might enjoy his work but have not been following it closely in its online form. But if you just want like little targeted bursts of kind of contrarian-ish hot takes on lots of stuff, this is a very nice collection. So you can keep it like by your bed or like by the toilet or something and just get like a little dose of Brian Kaplan and then go about your day. Labor Econ versus the World. Very delightful.
That's a horrifying
imagery.
I did it on purpose. Yeah. I wanted it to stick with you. And now it will.
It's your Neil Young revenge. Speaking of revenge, since last we gathered, I watched three war flicks, or basically war flicks, from three different eras that I had not seen before.
Wait, are you becoming a World War II dad?
Or was he always a war blogger?
Is See, one of them it's Stripes?
It's a life cycle.
I've actually seen Stripes several times. And you know, boom chugga-lugga or something. One of them was...
Lighten up, Francis.
Lighten up, Francis. One of them was Ridley Scott's The Last Duel, which is one of the stupidest, named things imaginable, even though it kind of makes sense in context, but it sort of gives a misleading thing. Another one was Peter Weir's Master and Commander. And then the third one that I hadn't seen all the way before was Patton from 1970. And I just put the three together just to say that Patton's not very good. Patton's not a good movie. I found this shocking. I had assumed because it was Patton and the big flag and the George C. Scott and Francis Ford Coppola wrote the screenplay that it was supposed to be some kind of great movie. It's not. Wow. It was kind of shocking.
What's your critique of it?
It's long, slow. Yeah. It's the music is bad. It's mostly about Patton kind of scheming and his sort of political maneuvers in a way to try to set up his last great triumph at the end of the European campaign. But it's just like the battle scenes aren't any good. The performances are great and it's memorable in that sense. But like it just as a thing to watch, it's just not gripping. It's long. It's slow. It's not in any kind of, you know, elegant way. It's very I was very surprised to learn that. And then people got mad at me when I pointed that out on Twitter. But basically what I want to talk about is that The Master and Commander is such a great movie. I'd heard people say this for a long time. I'd never seen it and I had some time. So I said, screw it, and watched it. And man, I just can't recommend that movie highly enough. It's so, It's what's his face?
Peter Weir.
No, I know,
Peter
but
who directed Witness and The Mosquito Coast?
Russell Crowe.
Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Russell Crowe's name's too much like Ridley Scott, so my brain can't handle it.
Well, and Russell Crowe was in Ridley Scott's Gladiator and his Robin Hood movie.
Exactly.
And,
so it's confusing.
And importantly, Russell Crowe does not sing in Master and Commander.
He should. Chop up the violin, though, very expertly with Paul.
I would highly recommend, Matt, if you can find the Mad Magazine parody of Patton. And
I think I must.
You will enjoy the movie. Once again,
if it's even half as good as Botched Casually in the Some Dunce Kid.
It's in the same league. Like there's a moment when Patton tells all of the people, all the soldiers who are wounded after he slaps one.
Yeah.
He tells them to do four laps around Libya, and then, and Carl Malden's
Omar Bradley.
Omar Bradley says, you know, but these guys are, you know, they can't move, and he's like, okay, for the cripples, two laps around Libya. It's very funny.
Much funnier than the actual movie. I can't. Master Commander is lovely. Paul Bettany, right? That's his name. The guy who plays the dude in the Vision guy in the MCU. Plays Doctor. The relationship between it's just so good and grips you from the beginning. Beautiful piece of cinema. So go check it out wherever you can. Okay, that's all the film criticism that we have time for. Many more war flicks next time, I think, for me. Check out all of our stuff at reason.com/podcasts. And if you like what we do generally, globally, think about supporting us. We're a nonprofit. Reason.com/donate tells you how you can do it, including on an ongoing monthly basis, daily basis, if you want. But anyways, check it out. We appreciate the support. It allows us to do things, experiment, have fun, and provide you content. Okay, thank you. See you next Monday.